Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to this very special holiday week of Inside the Hive. I'm Emily Jane Fox. I'm here with my co-host, Joe Hagan. Joe, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. I'm very thankful.
I feel incredibly grateful this year. I feel grateful to our listeners. I feel very grateful to you and that we've gotten to know each other in this very strange world. But it's been such a blessing.
We've been doing it right here with these listeners, getting to know each other, them getting to know us, us getting to know them, taking it week by week, which is all you can do.
Totally.
And, you know, we've gone through this incredible journey. There's been a lot of struggle. There's probably more struggle to come, but we're getting there together. And I have to say, whew, sigh of relief as we feel like we can actually start thinking about the future as a definitive thing that's going to happen.
Yes.
That's new.
Yes.
That's new.
I feel like this is the first Thanksgiving in probably 5 years for a few reasons where I'm not going to be around a dinner table and everyone's going to be asking me for the skinny on the crazy that's happening. Part of that is because I won't be around a big table of people this year.
Yeah.
But part of that is because the world is just sort of normalizing, and that's a beautiful thing, and that's something we should all be very thankful for. You know what else we have to be thankful for?
Barack Obama.
Barack Obama, baby. We're really lucky today as hosts, and I know you guys are going to love this as listeners. We have audio of an interview that Jesmyn Ward, the beautiful, beautiful author, writer, did with President Obama for the newest issue of Vanity Fair. And it's an interview surrounding his new book, which the sales just blew through the roof in the first week. I have not listened
Huge.
To it yet. My sister has been read it. My sister's been listening to it and says it's like the most incredible thing. It's a 29-hour audiobook, which...
Holy moly.
Joe, did you record your own audiobook?
You know, I didn't. And I was just talking about this with my wife, Samantha Hunt, who is a novelist and does her own audiobooks, which I didn't do. And she loved doing it.
Ugh.
But that's a lot of hours for Barack Obama to have logged.
I did my book. And I will tell you, writing a book is very hard. Recording the audiobook, I thought, was the hardest part because you have to get every word right as it's written. And so they stop you. If you misuse a preposition, or you make something plural, or sometimes when you're writing something, it's not the same as reading it. And so your mind just does weird things and changes things around, and they will stop you and make you start again. So I remember at the end of the day, my jaw was hurting, my throat hurt. And so I can't imagine recording for 29 hours. That's crazy.
No.
But bless him.
No.
Bless this interview. I think it's so cozy, and it really gets into such beautiful territory that I think is perfect for this week. It talks about sort of the soul of our country, and it's President Obama reflecting on where he's been and his presidency and his life and the future of this country. And Jesmyn Ward just did an absolutely phenomenal job, and I'm so glad that we get to hear it. I think it's such a beautiful thing, and we want to get you right to it. But Joe, I just want to ask you before we get into that, how you're feeling this Thanksgiving and what you guys are doing and what you're grateful for this year.
Well, I'm grateful that, you know, despite not being able to have a lot of visitors to the house, in fact, none, you know, we still got each other. We've got our family unit. We're going to be at home getting the turkey together and just, you know, doing it as best we can. We're going to watch movies and be cozy and try to make it as, you know, familial as we can with the family we've got. Right. That's what we're doing in America right now. You know, I'm thankful for a lot of things. But one thing I am very thankful for, and I want to stress this to our listeners, you know, we've got this Barack Obama book coming up. Should buy that book at an independent bookstore. Mm. As authors, we both know that, you know, when I had a book out and when you had a book out, you get supported by these bookstores.
Totally.
And they're all struggling right now. And so if you're going to buy that book, buy it at an independent bookstore.
Or buy anything, because there's so much consumption that happens this week. I've gotten 70 million emails just this morning about sales that are happening at retailers. And that's great. We should support the economy. We should support all retailers, all of whom are hurting this year. But if you can be thoughtful, and I know that everyone is going to do whatever feels good for their pocketbooks this year. It's a tough year and everyone should do what's mm-hmm. right for them and their families. But if you can support a local store this week in particular, you know where your dollars are going. You know who it's impacting because they probably rung you up at that store before. You probably know who the owners are. If you don't, I'm sure it's very easy to find out. And so just be conscious with how you're spending. And also, just generally this year, the thing that I'm thinking about is just how to be the most thoughtful, both in how I'm spending and who I'm spending time with digitally or outside in person, and what I'm choosing to bring into my life. I think we're now at a point where we can stop and kind of pause, both because of the pandemic and also because the news cycle is changing. And I know, Joe, we think about this a lot in terms of mm-hmm. what we're going to cover and write about, but I think everyone can sort of think about this. We have the yep. blessing to choose how we're going to spend our time now. We don't have to be engaged in all the mishigas anymore.
That's right. Hit the reset button. You can now filter for joy and not filter for fear and anxiety.
Totally.
Right?
Fill
Think
your
about
life.
What you want. Be conscious about it. You've really taught me that this year, and I'm thankful for that, Emily Jane Fox. You've been really on this beat, which I appreciate. And you just profiled somebody who has a shaman in the recent issue of Vanity Fair, which everybody should go check that out. But, you know, you've made me aware, and I appreciate this, and I think our listeners do too, about thinking about ways in which you can be grateful. Mm. And so here is the week that we have nationalized that idea of gratitude, and let's be grateful for what we have here, for each other, and for this Barack Obama interview.
I agree. Let's get to it. I'm grateful for this. I'm grateful for you. It's my favorite holiday. Enjoy this episode. We can't wait to hear what you think about it. Read the written Q&A in Vanity Fair, the newest issue. It's online on The Hive. Jasmine Ward does a beautiful job. Thank you to Barack Obama, which is something we should all be grateful being able to say.
Here.
Let's get to it.
Let's go.
Are you still there, Jasmine?
Yes, I am. I don't know what happened to my view.
That's okay. Well, I mean, you've seen me before. You know what I look like.
With the first one that was about humor, I don't know. I guess I wanted to ask you about that because it was such a surprise for me. And I don't want to say that and like disparage your other work, right? But I don't know. It was a surprise to me. Like I laughed out loud, like really laughed out loud. Not, there's no hyperbole here. Several times during like my reading of the book. And so I don't know. It was such a cool thing to see happening on the page. And because I, you know, talk about how to use humor, you know, when I teach creative writing, right. I was just wondering like, if if that was like a conscious decision on your part to incorporate it into your work, or if you learned how to do that through reading, because I looked at, like, I'd get to the end of a section and you tell a joke. Well, not tell a joke, but you would say something really funny. And I was like, that's really good. Like, technically, the humor was working really well.
Well, that's good. I'll say two things first. First of all, Michelle is funnier than me.
Yeah.
So I have to say that.
Okay.
She insists that she is. And the reason she's funnier than me, and she's a naturally just a great storyteller. Part of it is also there's a rule in our household that she can tease me, but I cannot tease her. And I've pointed out that's not fair. And she says, yeah, so what? And so I'm often the brunt of her humor, and the girls have picked up on that. So at the dinner table, generally, I'm the recipient of mockery and jokes. I think whatever humor comes through in the book is a reflection of me trying to accurately capture my voice and the back and forth with my family, friends, and staff during this journey. And I think that, you know, all of us use humor to some degree or another to help explain the world around us, right? I think it was some literary critic, you know, talking about Shakespeare, who once said that tragedy is when you are in the middle of the story. Comedy is when you're standing outside looking at the story. The human condition can be absurd. And if you learn to laugh about it, then that helps you get through pain and hardship and difficulty. It's part of the reason why the African-American community has been the source of so much humor in our culture generally, is because we've had to face up to the absurdity of things happening to us that don't make sense, aren't fair, are often tragic and heartbreaking. And so we empower ourselves by being able to pull out and take a bigger view of it. And, I think I've absorbed that. And that was part of how I managed to maintain perspective and take the work of the presidency seriously, or running for president seriously, but not take myself too seriously. There's a scene I write in the book, which I think is a story that had been told before by some others who were there, but when we're debating whether we can still move forward on the Affordable Care Act and get it passed, and my legislative director says, it's a really narrow path we've got here, depends on whether you feel lucky. And I say, listen, where am I? He said, well, you're in the Oval Office. And what's my name? Yeah. Barack Obama. No, it's Barack Hussein Obama. I'm always lucky. I always feel lucky. But that was an example of using humor at a time when the stakes were incredibly high and we were feeling really embattled. And that both signaled to my team that, look, we have a chance to do something important. Let's try. And, the worst that can happen is we fail, but, if we fail, at least, we know that we will have done everything we could. And in some ways, that laughing about it or some gallows humor about those situations worked better when you were dealing with stress day in, day out the way we were, than if you were, trying to give some sober speech Mm-hmm. And all of which is to say, yes, Jesmyn, I am funny. I slayed at the correspondence dinner. The professional comics never wanted to follow me. Come on now.
I remember that, and I am going to agree with you that that Michelle is very funny. There's that part where you go to the beach with Sasha, and Michelle doesn't go, and then she says like that was her one aim as first lady to never be captured on film in a bathing suit. I chuckled at that one. I couldn't stop laughing. I was like, oh my God, she's so funny.
Although she wasn't joking about that.
No, she wasn't. I could tell. She was serious.
She was all like, this is one of my main goals as first lady. I will not be photographed by the paparazzi in a bathing suit. And she succeeded.
This is Inside the Hive.
3, 2, 1. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/hive.
I know that we have a limited amount of time to talk, and I really want to ask you about characters and about empathy, that fourth question that I sent you. Because I just want to hear you talk about empathy, because you explicitly talk about empathy several times in Promised Land, right? And so one of the things that I noticed as I was reading, as I was like attempting to just sort of read as a reader and enjoy it, but also sort of trying to read like a writer, right? And mm-hmm. being aware of how you were writing the book and of the techniques you're using. One of the things that I was really impressed by was how well you develop your characters. Like you do a really great job of like developing your main and secondary characters, or just establishing them in a few words when you first introduce them. Mm-hmm. And in those, like in that initial, when you first introduce your characters, then it's a huge cast of characters there. And this is from Rom to Hillary to characters who have like secondary roles, like Norm Eisen or Sonia Maria Sotomayor, but still, when we encounter these characters on the page, every character, you give us a very specific, particular impression of them from the first moment. You know, you give us sensory details about them, you give us hints about their personality and their motivation, and they're really vivid and really immediate. And I was struck by that. I thought that worked really well. And so I asked myself, like, how do you think he's able to do this? You know, like how is he able to accomplish this? And then I was wondering if your capacity for empathy is part of what enables you to do that. You know?
Yeah. I think, let me say at the outset that part of the goal of the book was to connect my personal journey with the public life that people saw. And I think so often when we see a political figure or we're talking about policy, we somehow think that's separate and apart from our daily lives. And what I wanted to do for the reader, particularly for young people, is to give them a sense of commonality between their day-to-day choices, decisions, insights, hopes, fears, and what somebody who ends up being the president of the United States is going through. He is a person like you who is interacting with people, who is trying to do stuff, is disappointed sometimes, is afraid, is falls short, has doubts. And so in order for people to capture that progression, that journey of me as a young person inspired by the civil rights movement through my early political career all the way through to the presidency, that required people to have a sense of how I saw the world. And the way I see the world and actually merges with my politics, because what got me into politics was this belief, this sense that we are, all of us, imprinted with history and our gene pool and the particulars of our lives, but we also have something in common, and it's possible for us to really see each other and hear each other's voices and find commonality in our experience, and that is possible across gender and race and nationality and sexual orientation, and that if America is exceptional in any way, it's exceptional because we are a country that is filled with people from every corner of the globe. And we are forced to figure out how do we live with each other and find common cause with each other. And so I think that the empathy you describe is central to my politics. The reason that I got into politics was the sense that as shattering as the experiences of race and discrimination and slavery and Jim Crow and the decimation of Native American tribes and all that stuff, there is still something in this country that says we can be better and we can learn to be more inclusive and see each other and expand our definition of we the people. That's always been at the core of my politics. And when I write, what I'm trying to do is reflect how I see people in that same way, that I'm trying to understand their backstory. I'm trying to get a sense of what's motivating them. What are the things that they feel, believe, hope, fear, that I can relate to? Because if I can do that, doesn't mean I'm going to agree with them on everything, but at least maybe they can see me. And, it's part of the challenge of our politics right now is that there's so many forces designed to prevent us from seeing each other, right? And to label each other and distance and fear each other. And I wanted to make sure that this book reflected an opposite belief that in fact we can know each other. And that's one very specific example that I wanted to use was the grassroots work that I did first as an organizer and then actually reflected itself in our campaign in Iowa. You know, I spent a whole chapter writing about how we won Iowa with all these young volunteers who were thrown into these rural communities. And as I emphasize in the book, These young people, most of them in their 20s, you know, these are Black kids from Brooklyn or Asian American kids from California or, you know, Jewish kids from Chicago. Many of them had never been in a rural, white, you know, primarily farm community. And they'd go into these little small towns, but they would go out there and they'd talk to people and they'd hear their stories and find out what it felt like when you got laid off from the plant that was really part of the company town, or they'd, you know, hear about some family that didn't have healthcare and were struggling, and they made connections and established relationships and loyalty with people who were not like them. And when we won the Iowa caucus, we won because hopefully people related to what I was saying, but more than anything, we won because these young people had learned to see, hear, empathize with the people they were working with.
That in part, I think, is what readers want from memoir, is they want, you know, us as writers to like slow down, open up moments in seeing with other people, you know, with us as a narrator and then with other people, and begin to like assess, you know, who the people in that moment were, what they were feeling, what they were bringing to that situation, why we perhaps acted the way we did, why they reacted the way they did, like the reader. Well,
and that's the wisdom. Look, you think about your own books, Jesmyn, like despite being African-American, I don't know what it's like to grow up in Mississippi or a rural part of the South. But when I read your books, I certainly don't know what it's like to be a pregnant young girl, Black girl growing up in the South. The act of you describing an interior life makes me understand her and stand in her shoes and see through her eyes. And that expands my world. And that should inform how I interact with my own daughters, how I interact with the people in my community, and hopefully informs my politics. So, you know, in some ways, I guess part of my argument here is that I think bringing a writer's sensibility to politics is a valuable thing, because at the end of the day, our public life is really just a story. If you think about Donald Trump, he had a certain story he was telling about this country. I have a different story. Joe Biden has a different story. Kamala Harris has a different story. And so we have these competing narratives that are taking place all the time. And I think that the insight, the wisdom, the generosity that you show in your books is part of what I want to inform our political life as well. You know, if we can understand each other in that kind of granular way, as opposed to just, all right, that's a white male, that's a Hispanic female, that's a rich person, that's a broke person. You know, those categories in the aggregate can give you some data, can give you some insight into how the society is organized, but it doesn't really give you a feel for what's churning inside us. We're bigger than our various demographics and data points. And that's, I think, something that we sometimes forget, and part of why our politics can get so divided.
In creative nonfiction, Mark, we always say that you should make yourself into a character. You know, like you have to think about yourself as a character and think about what you're defined, how you're going to convey your defining characteristics But I think that, you know, throughout A Promised Land, you're so good at making the people that you write about, including yourself, seem complex and complicated, and like multifaceted, and so capable of like all the emotions along the emotional spectrum, and I think that there's power in that because then the reader perceives you as a complicated human being, right? And the reader perceives the people that you're writing about as complicated human beings. And then, I mean, I believe that makes the reader feel sympathy for you. You know, that makes the reader think about, you know, when they might have felt the same thing in their own life, in their own job, in their own, you know, family lives, right? So,
I appreciate that. And I do think that part of the advantage that I probably had in writing this book was having written an early book when I was pretty young, 33, about my journey to understand my father and my heritage. That was a useful exercise for me. By the time I wrote this book 25 years later, I had had a conversation with myself about, all right, where did I come from? What cross currents run through me? What are my demons? What are my fears? And I think that there is probably more confidence at the age of 58, 59, in letting that show, letting readers see that, being less protective of yourself. Because you've come to terms with both your strengths and your weaknesses, and I wanted people to see that once again, in part because I want young people, more than anything, I want young people to feel confident in their capacity to move through the world, change the world, be agents of justice and let their voices, shine through and understand that our public lives, our communal lives are not something that you have to leave to somebody else. You are as qualified as anybody to talk about what is right and just and trust yourself in that. And so I wanted them to see this process of as I point out in the book, I wasn't like student body president. Mm-hmm. I wasn't somebody who was from a political family. The inspirations I drew from were also young people like a John Lewis or a Diane Nash when they were in their early 20s, taking on an entire system of Jim Crow and putting themselves in such severe danger. And I didn't duplicate that kind of courage and success, but in my own way, I said, all right, let me try this out. I wanted people to see the ups and downs of even a successful political career. All right, so I tell a story about how being frustrated in the state legislature, I decided to run for Congress without really thinking it through and get whooped. I then went to the Democratic National Convention in 2000, licking my wounds coming off a loss. And it's a good story about how I show up in LA. Turns out I don't have the right pass, so I can't really get in the convention hall. I've run down my credit card. I'm broke. I can't rent a car. I'm not on the list for the parties. I'm sleeping on the friend's out. Oh, no. I end up leaving. And 4 years later, I'm the keynote at the Democratic National Convention. Yep. And sort of the bell of the ball. But the point is, I want people to feel that that's those ups and downs of a public life, which aren't so different than the ups and downs of all our lives, right? Yeah. You know, we all go through these moments where everything seems to work and moments where nothing seems to work. And I wanted people to feel that as much as possible.
So do you think that that's part of the reason why? Because my next question was about like this concept in, you know, in nonfiction, memoir, writing towards material that may be painful for you, you know, and writing towards it instead of writing away from it. So do you think that's part of the reason why you were so committed in A Promised Land to like writing towards, you know, just intimate sort of painful, you know, moments that you experienced from, you know, say like losing the losing that election or, you know, there's a lot that you write about, like how difficult it was for you and Michelle to sort of navigate your relationship and your family life at the time, you know, during this, you know, time.
Well, because look, that pain is often some of the most profound experiences that we have. It leaves marks on us. It leaves scars. It shapes us. And you know, I want people to know that we all have in common loss. We all have in common disappointment. We all have in common that sense of things not being in our control that we thought were in our control. And I think that has to inform our politics and our public lives. You know, I talked briefly in the book about Jeremiah Wright, who was a hugely controversial figure during my campaign, who was an extraordinarily gifted, complicated person. One of the most gifted preachers I ever heard, built this amazing institution that gave back in the community of the South Side of Chicago, you know, did so much good, but he had a bunch of pain from the experience of being a Black man who had grown up in the pre-civil rights era, and you know, went through the revolution of attitudes in the 60s and was still angry and hurt, and in that way reflected the anger, hurt, scars, pain of the Black community, and would then sometimes let that out in ways that you know, weren't always on point. And the pain of me having to, at some point, sever a relationship with somebody who I cared about. And then also to have to deliver a speech on race that captures that complexity, which then led me to go back and tell a story about my grandmother, a white woman who had grown up during the Great Depression, who loved me more than anything in her life, but also told me, or I learned, was scared of a black man panhandling at a bus stop. And so in both instances, what I'm doing is both capturing these two complicated people who were important in my life, and trying to make sense of that. And trying to also describe the pain of me being surprised by them having attitudes in certain cases that I didn't agree with, but then still insisting that they're still part of me. And then trying to describe to the country that, by the way, they're both part of America. And we're going to have to learn how to understand that and acknowledge that. I don't get there if I'm trying to sanitize all those things, I guess is what I'm saying. And it's important, I think, in the book for me to share with readers that those were difficult moments for me. That it was painful personally. It wasn't just a matter of coming up with some simple morality tale. If you want to address race in America, it's all tangled up. And there are a lot of scars and pain and memories. And that it's one of the reasons why I think so often when you hear people say, well, we need to talk more about race, sometimes I'm skeptical of those conversations where they're, you know, these formalized, let's have a dialogue about race, because so often we actually avoid talking about the stuff that really hurts. And it's one of the great values of literature is often we're able to access that pain more effectively. And when I say literature, it doesn't have to be fiction. I mean, obviously Beloved and Toni Morrison's work does it, but A Fire Next Time by James Baldwin remains as relevant today as it did when he wrote it 50 years ago. It is searing, and it is all about pain. And yet, ultimately, is probably necessary in order to progress. We have to be able to internalize the things James Baldwin's talking about in that essay, and be able to look at that squarely.
This is Inside the Hive.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter, to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
You're very honest, in your assessments, in the context that you give us, in the history that you give us, in your in the way that you sort of communicate about what you were feeling at different moments, in your emotions, and like you're very honest. And I read your first book, which is, your first book to me resembles a promised land, just in I guess in form and how, I don't know, like in a way and how like intimate it is. I guess I just wanted to ask, like, how much freedom did you feel like you had in a promised land to be so forthright and honest, and whether or not that was like difficult for you to navigate to page by page as you attempted to weigh the worth of like sharing some insightful private fact or assessment, and then while thinking about what the fallout might be, right? You sharing.
Yeah. I didn't find it difficult to share what I felt or thought. Mm-hmm. For the reason I said earlier, mm-hmm. I'm 59. Mm-hmm. I've been around the track a bunch of times now. I said to somebody once, towards the end of my presidency, one of the great gifts of the presidency is that you lose your fear. Because, look, I came into the presidency in the middle of what was then the worst financial disaster and economic crisis since the Great Depression. We had two wars. I had to make a series of very difficult and risky decisions. Early on, some of them worked, some of them didn't work as I had intended. I was, like all presidents, subject to withering criticism at certain points and second guessing. And I survived it. You know, you look at it and you say, "Well, I'm still here." I've made some good calls. I've made some mistakes. I've experienced losses as well as some victories. And lo and behold, although my hair is grayer, I'm still standing. And so I felt free to describe what I truly thought about a whole range of issues. I think what was probably more difficult during the writing process was how much I felt comfortable sharing conversations I had had or feelings others had who I was close to. So with Michelle, for example, obviously a lot of the book is the story of our love and our partnership and the sacrifices she made for the career path I chose. And needing to be honest about the fact that, she really didn't want me to be in politics. And it hurt her in a lot of ways. I was helped by the fact that she wrote her book first. Mm-hmm. So she had already put out some of that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much me, pulling back the curtain. She had already done that. I was just kind of given my perspective in terms of how I felt about her distress around some of our decisions. But there are times where I was like, well, this snippet of dialogue, would that person feel comfortable with me sharing that? I think at the end, the decision I made was that as long as I was generous in my assessment of their outlook and what they were feeling, then it was okay for me to share. Now, look, I want to be honest that probably how I phrase things in the book might be different than how I would phrase things if you and I were just sitting around the kitchen table. Mm-hmm. If I'm talking about, Mitch McConnell's filibusters blocking important legislation of mine, you know, I'm probably more judicious in how I describe that than if you and I were just talking. I might, there might be a few, you know, expletives sprinkled in there. but, you know, so I was trying to maintain a little bit of decorum.
Which you did. You did.
I did my best. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Joseph Biden, right, recently won the election. Yes. You know.
Hallelujah.
Yes. real full body relief that I have felt over the past, you know, on Saturday. So one of the things that I feel like I've noticed, and I've been thinking about it specifically because I've been reading your book, you know, during the past week, is I feel like people are more clear-eyed about, in response to the election, that people, that Democrats, I'll say, are more sort of clear-eyed about the fact that how we have to be more civically engaged and civically minded, you know, and that everything is not, you know, just because it's one person is elected to this office, right, that doesn't mean that all of our work is done. I feel like there's a difference in understanding now, right, that I saw, that I don't think was there, and I definitely was guilty of it, you know, when you were elected for the first time. I thought, you know, miraculous thing, right? I'm like, oh, everything's great, right? And you wrote about that in A Promised Land, right? About how you had a sense of double consciousness and you were sort of anxious about this idea that, you know, that people were sort of projecting their, you know, you became a symbol in some ways, and people are projecting their sort of needs and desires and wants and dreams. It was like wish fulfillment all on you, and you were aware of that, and because you were clear-eyed about what the job would entail and the kind of work, you know, that everyone really still has to do. So do you I guess I'm asking, do you think that's true? Do you see a difference in our ability to be more clear-eyed about this?
Well, I hope so. I mean, we always want to learn from our experience, and part of, I'm glad you raised this, Jasmine, because I really think this is one of the goals of the book, is for people to understand a little bit more about how our government works. Mm-hmm. Because I do think that we have this sense that the president is a king, mm-hmm. who we elect him and hopefully at some point her, mm-hmm. and whatever it is that they want to do, they can get done. And if something doesn't get done, it's because they didn't care about it.
Yeah.
And part of what I try to describe in the book is the incredible number of institutional roadblocks and barriers and constraints on even the president's power. The president is extraordinarily powerful, but so is Congress, and so is the Supreme Court, and so are corporations, and so are governors. And we have all these different points of power, all these levers and buttons throughout our society that help determine our direction. And you know, oftentimes, I think people, particularly Democrats, but I think this is undoubtedly true for Republicans as well, they think, all right, we got this person elected. Mm-hmm. Now, when are we going to reform the criminal justice system? When are we going to make sure that we have universal daycare? why haven't we immediately, dealt with climate change? Mm-hmm. And when change doesn't happen fast enough, we have a tendency to feel cynical, mm-hmm. And to feel like, oh, they sold out, or, you know, they weren't really paying attention to the things I thought they cared about, and disappointment and then disengagement sets in. And part of what I wanted to do in this book, and it's one of the reasons why I go into detail about how hard it was to get the Affordable Care Act passed, for example. And at the time, there were a lot of Democrats and progressives who said, well, this isn't good enough. Why don't we have a single payer plan? Why don't we have a public option? There's still people who are uninsured even after the bill got passed. It's not enough. And I try to explain, we had to do everything and pull every rabbit out of a hat that we could to get 23 million people health insurance, because it turned out, even with large Democratic majorities in the Senate, you had this thing called the filibuster in the Senate, which allowed Republicans to block any legislation unless we could get 60 votes. And that meant that we had to get every single vote we had. And there are some conservative Democrats from Nebraska or West Virginia or other places that might not agree with Democrats from Brooklyn or San Francisco about a particular issue. And you're trying to manage all that. And I think the more we understand that, the more we will be effective in our advocacy, because then we can start saying to ourselves, all right, yes, we need to elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but now we also need to make sure that we have a Democratic Senate, and there are going to be two Georgia seats coming up in a special election that could give the Democrats at least the tiebreaker to get legislation through. We have governors, we have state legislators. We saw this summer this incredible outpouring of activism around criminal justice and police brutality. And you know, the fact of the matter is that the overwhelming majority of criminal laws and prosecutions take place under state law, which means that if you really want reform, then you've got to have district attorneys who believe in reform, and you've got to have mayors who are appointing police chiefs who are willing to negotiate with police unions to make sure that their training and accountability is different than it currently is. And that's actually not something that the president has any direct power over. The president can encourage it, as we did after what happened in Ferguson. Occasionally you can get the Justice Department and the Civil Rights Division there to impose a consent decree on a particular jurisdiction so that it changes its behavior. But most of those decisions are done locally. So the bottom line is that the more we know about how the system works, the more effective we are going to be in actually bringing about change. That doesn't mean, by the way, and I try to emphasize this in the book, I did not shy away from, or at least I recognized the fact that I was a symbol, and that symbol is important. You know, I was just seeing your kids and your niece and nephew, and there was a generation of kids who grew up seeing a African-American first family in the White House. And by the way, that didn't just have an impact on African-American kids, it had an impact on white kids who took that for granted. It was not unusual to see suddenly a person of color in that leadership position. And that has value too, right? It's not all about policy. It's also about spirit and inspiration, and you know, I don't denigrate the symbolic role of my election. I think that was meaningful. It was one of the reasons I was inspired to run, because I thought it would have some impact. But it is not by itself sufficient to change, you know, the history of discrimination and you know, the structural inequities that have built up over 400 years. For that, you got to look at budgets, and you've got to look at laws, and we have to be clear-eyed about how difficult it is to move this society forward, and not be discouraged when it doesn't happen overnight.
This is Inside the Hive.
What do you want us to take from A Promised Land? If we had to take one big, you know, theme or one big idea, or is there something that we haven't talked about that perhaps you want the readers or the audience to take with them?
I think I hint at it in the preface. Mm-hmm. I hope when people read this, in addition to thinking, well, this is a good story, in addition to young people hopefully being inspired that maybe I too can get involved in public service in some fashion, even if it's not elective office, but I want to be involved in the course of our society. More than anything, I want people to come away with a sense that I really do believe America is exceptional, but maybe not for the reasons that sometimes we think. It's not because we're the wealthiest nation on earth, or we have the most powerful military on earth. It's because uniquely among great powers throughout history, we are not only a democracy, but we are a multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy. And that we have fought battles internally over several centuries now to try to expand the number of people who can sit at the table, who qualify as we the people, Black folks and poor folks and women and the LGBTQ community and immigrants. And if we can make that work, if we can learn to embrace each other under a common creed and respect each other and treat every child in our care with regard and concern, then that is what makes us that shining city on a hill. That's the example that the world looks for, that American idea is worth preserving. But it only works if we acknowledge that the reality, the idea, don't match. And that what we can take pride in is not, oh, it's always been great, and if you criticize it or you protest or you, you know, try to, take down the Confederate flag, that somehow that means you're un-American or you don't love America. No. What we love about America is the fact that we're noisy and we'll protest and we complain and we fuss and we struggle. And at each juncture, then we become a little more just and a little more fair and a little more empathetic, and more voices are heard, and more people have a seat at the table. And if we can keep on doing that, then we can teach, or at least set an example for the rest of the world. And that's important because, as I said, say in my preface, the divisions that play themselves out in the United States are not unique to the United States. There are other countries that are struggling with racial issues. There are countries like Northern Ireland, where the people look indistinguishable, but are just as bitterly divided historically around religious issues. There are, ethnic conflicts in every corner of the globe. And as the world shrinks and cultures collide because of social media and the internet and 24/7 television, if we don't learn to live together, we will perish. We can't solve big problems like climate change or global inequality unless we can see each other and listen to each other and learn to work together. And I hope that anybody reading this book says it's worth us investing in the promise of America, even as we understand that, as Moses understood and Dr. King, proclaimed in a speech just right before he got shot. We may not get there, but we can see it, and it's on behalf of those beautiful children of yours and my daughters and children everywhere that we keep on fighting to make sure they get there, even if we don't.
Thank you very much.
That was fun. It's great to see you. Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
From PRX.